The programme which follows is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM.
You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM and DAB in London. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's monthly show about comics, graphic novels, and sequential art. In this month's show, I'm talking to three writers and aficionados of comics who are best known for their work in the crime genre. Later in this evening's show, you'll hear my interview with Brian Azzarello. Best known for his long-form comic, 100 Bullets, Brian has also penned a number of memorable Batman titles in recent years, including the graphic novel Joker and the recent Batman Damned. However, to start off with, in a conversation that was recorded on stage at the Lakes International Comic Art Festival, I'm talking to Scott's crime writer Ian Rankin and John Wagner, who's written a great number of Judge Dredd strips for 2000 AD over the last 40 years. Wagner also wrote the graphic novel A History of Violence, which was turned into a film by David Cronenberg a few years ago. And while Ian isn't well known for his involvement in comics, he did write a John Constantine graphic novel a few years ago called Dark Entries, contributed strips to Mark Miller's anthology comic Clint, and more recently has contributed a story to the First World War short story anthology Traces of the Great War. In my Q&A with John and Ian, we'll be talking about all of these things in a panel discussion that was called Crime Lords. Ian is best known as a crime novelist, but has dipped his toes into comics a few times with the Constantine graphic novel Dark Entries, and more recently a 10-page story in the Traces of the Great War anthology that's being launched this weekend. John Wagner has been writing comics most of his life, many of which have involved crime. Obviously, his very long-running stint on Judge Dredd, as well as other strips published in Rebellion and by other British publishers. I thought I might start off with your formative years, because the age of 12 seems to be an important age for both of you. John, it was when you moved from America to the UK, which I guess establishes your kind of mid-Atlantic tone as a writer. And Ian, according to Rankin on Rebus, at the age of 12, you gave up comics and started buying music instead. So I was wondering what kind of comics you read before the age of 12 and how long you went cold turkey for.
I think that must be a misprint, surely. I didn't stop reading comics. I stopped thinking that I could be a comics book writer and illustrator. Because the first things I ever wrote were comics. I mean, I would get bits of paper and fold them in half to make four-page booklets. And I would have, you know, four strip stories, one on each page, breaking it up into tiny wee squares with tiny wee stick people. And I would put a free gift on the front. I would make a badge or something with a bit of cardboard, shape a bit of cardboard and put a bit of a safety pin and a sellotape on the back, and stick it on the front going, free gift this week. Because all comics had free gifts back in the 60s. That was why you bought them. And, you know, there'd be a sports story and maybe a space story and stuff like that. Limited to one copy of each. But I think by about the age of 12, I'd got much more interested in music and thought, no, I'm never going to be a comics book guy. I'm going to be a rock star or a pop star. So I then focused my attention on writing lyrics for non-existent bands and forming a top 10 every week, which meant nine other bands and all the personnel, and then taking the bands on tour and designing their album sleeves and doing pretty much what I'd been doing when I was trying to do comics, which is creating an alternative universe where I could continue to play God.
Nice. And John, when you were growing up, were you buying American comics when you lived in America and then did that switch?
No, we couldn't afford the comics. I read a few that other people had, Batman, Superman. I wasn't particularly interested in comics, and mainly because I didn't see many of them. The one I did identify with was Uncle Scrooge, because of my Scottish ancestry. I always felt there was some kinship there, although I never made his kind of money.
But while you were making comics, was there also a point where you started reading them as well?
Oh, yeah, well, I started reading them when I, in Greenock, I got a paper round. Mm. And before you went out, you had probably half an hour, so I would read all the comics from the shelf, and then walking round, I would read other people's comics and stick these tatty dog-eared things in the postbox when I'd finished with them. So I did. That's when my comic reading started, really.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a little mining village in Fife in Scotland in the 60s, and my parents had left school at 14, 15, didn't read books really. But comics were affordable literacy. I'm interested to hear John say that his family couldn't afford them because, you know, a couple of pennies could get you one of the DC Thompson comics. And I mean, I started off probably with a Bimbo, you know, before I could walk. And then it was straight into Beano and Dandy and Topper and Whizzer and Chips and all that, segueing nicely into Hotspur and Victor and then Lion and Tiger, which were a bit more expensive, but were more adult material, I guess, kind of more grown-up stories. And then 2000 AD eventually came along when I was in my teens, and that grabbed me as well. So there was that continuum. And it was, I think we spoke about it a wee bit yesterday in at least one of the panels, about it being a rung of the literacy ladder that was going to take you to the next step, you know? And I just was, I had a huge collection of comics. It was the American ones were frustrating because our local grocers, they were all hanging up on a clothesline above the counter with clothes pegs. And you would go, I'll take that one. And it would be Spider-Man. But then you would miss the following three or four issues and then jump back in again. So you never, I never quite was up to speed on what, how these storylines were going to continue. So I was much more keen on the DC Thompson school because they came, you know, they were in the newsagents every week, and every week you'd go and get them. And it was probably my first, because people sometimes say there's not many, I mean, we're here today to talk about it, there's not many detectives in comics, there's not much, or there never used to be much in the way of detective stuff in comics. Judge Dredd, it kind of started to break the mould to a certain extent. But one of them, and it was either Tiger or Lion, I forget, had Zip Nolan. And Zip That's Nolan right, was a two yeah. or three page that actually had physical clues in the pictures, and Zip Nolan, his highway cop, would solve it at the end, and he would say, "Have you seen what Zip Nolan has seen? Can you solve this story?" And that was probably the first time I ever came across that notion that you could do a kind of whodunit with red herrings and clues in a really tight two or three page comic strip.
Mm. I actually wrote one or two of those.
There you go.
After the first three or four clues, you kind of run out of good visual clues that you can give people. I think the thing about comics in Britain is that compared to American comics, they were cheap. Mm. I mean, tuppence, threepence back in the old days. So that made them quite accessible. Mm. So it was far easier to read not just one, but quite a few.
Mm. Well, and I mean, if we look at your earlier strips, John, the I guess gritty is a word that would work for a lot of the artwork. And I guess that's because British comics, until about the mid-80s, were printed on such cheap paper that the art would have to be really, you know, kind of bold and in your face in order for it to be reprinted legibly. Did that kind of affect the sort of storytelling that you were doing?
No, I don't think I worried too much about that. I mean, to me, the story was always the essential thing, and then I'd leave the art to the artist or the editor. I didn't often get to choose what artist I was working with. It was mandated, you'll be doing this with Cruz or whoever. So it's only since 2000 AD started that you actually got to collaborate more with artists and to work together with a particular artist that you liked.
Well, I was going to say someone like Arthur Ransom, you know, when the paper stock did improve, then you could actually have this beautiful detailed artwork.
It does make a difference,
So, Ian, in terms of comics that were perhaps formative for you as a writer, I read an interview with you a few years ago, and you mentioned the work of Alan Moore, which is why a couple of Swamp Thing covers are in rotation on this PowerPoint. Was it British writers who are working on American comics, like John, like Alan Moore, like others, who perhaps fed into your imagination more?
Yeah. I mean, there was that lovely thing that happened, the British invasion, where a lot of the people who had been working on 2000 AD suddenly crossed the Atlantic, either physically or their work crossed the Atlantic, and then started to feed back into the UK again. And I remember it well, 1986, I was 26, I just got married, moved to London, living in Tottenham. And there was a comic shop at Seven Sisters, and I went along to the comic shop in Seven Sisters, and the guy there just struck up a friendship with him, and he would just turn me on to all these different, you know, all these new things that were happening. Watchmen, he said, you know, check out Watchmen, number one. He said, you know, in fact, I think he gave me number two, and I said, have you got number one? He went, yeah, I've got one, I've still got one left of that. And I went, oh, Alan Moore, he's the guy from 2000 AD, you know, who used to do the kind of time twisters and things, which I'd really loved, and D.R. and Quinch, which I really loved. But 2000 AD was hugely important from my kind of mid to late teens on. In fact, my wife is still furious with me because on our wedding day, Saturday morning, she went to the hairdressers to get her hair done. I went out and bought 2000 AD, as usual, to get it read before the wedding because I thought probably not going to get it read this afternoon, so I better get it this morning. But it was that kind of thing. It was that kind of, you know, weekly fix and exciting new voices. And actually the start of seeing crime and people who solve crime back in comics again, Judge Dredd, Robo Hunter. There were a few of them around that kind of had that, the template was a template of the whodunit or the thriller or the crime story, but doing really interesting things with them.
Mm. Well, and also, I mean, you know, thinking of your work, John, having that mid-Atlantic voice, that seems to be something that has always sort of influenced Judge Dredd. People talk of Dirty Harry as being one of the early inspirations, yeah. You know, a cop who can operate beyond, you know, the boundaries of the law. Was that sort of freedom to create a world where the boundaries of justice can be sort of evolving from story to story something that appealed?
Oh yeah. And the thing about Judge Dredd was the story was too wide and all-encompassing, I thought, to set it in Britain. Britain was too small. It needed the space and the bigness and the extremities of the United States, or what was the United States, for the story to work properly. Which is why when I came to do Strontium Dog, I made sure to set that in Britain as a sort of balance. But, the opportunities for stories in a city like Mega City One are just immense. Actually, I saw Mega City One when I went to Istanbul. I don't know if anyone's been to Istanbul, but it just seems to go on and on and on with bigger and bigger buildings. You go around a corner, there's more of it. I thought, this is Mega City One, this is what it's like.
Mm. And also, I guess it's the classic sci-fi trope that when you have buildings that tall, and I guess you get it in the real world as well, that the ultra-rich are at the top and the ultra-poor at the bottom, and that inequality leads to crime, you know, to start off with.
Usually with a separate entrance.
Yeah. I used to love that when I was reading the Judge Dredd ones with notes and all the in-jokes, but also seeing that a lot of it set in the future was really talking about stuff that was happening in here and now. So this notion of people who just lived in their cars or their kind of Winnebagos that just drove around endlessly on an automatic drive because they couldn't afford housing. You go, that's kind of where we are as a society. People are living out of their cars, not just in the US, but elsewhere. And the problems with things like violence, street art, graffiti, you name it, and obesity. I just love the kind of the eating competitions. Just phenomenal. And, you know, a few years down the line, you go, that's kind of where we are. As a society, and that's what the British authors seem to, a lot of them, and artists seem to bring to the comics, was that sense of, you know, quite right on satire.
Mm.
You know, it was pointing the finger at us, and saying, you know, you realise that although this is, you think it's set in the future, it's actually talking about you.
Mm.
Alan Grant had a theory that the reason Judge Dredd didn't go down quite so well in America was because the things we were depicting in Dredd were already happening over there. It was nothing special, nothing. That was their life, you know, belly wheels and all sorts.
Then I guess as real life becomes more extreme, then Dredd has to become more extreme to respond to that.
Yeah.
I mean, you've said in the past, John, that the favourite strip of yours in the Judge Dredd world that you wrote was America, where I think, for the first time, at least on an extended narrative, it's actually the characters within Mega City One that the story focuses on and how everyday lives are actually crushed by the justice system.
I wanted something really broad and sweeping that covered the whole existence of Mega City One and what it was like to actually grow up in a city like that. So Dredd became a sort of peripheral character, a kind of shadow in the background. Which I quite often, Alan and I have written stories where Dredd doesn't appear, and we still call them Judge Dredd, which is good that you can do that with a character, because partly the city is the character as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even visually, right from the start of America, where you have the statue of the Justice Department towering over the Statue of Liberty, you know, from that very simple but very effective visual, you're showing how the justice system in Mega City One, even if it doesn't actually work in terms of, you know, the millions and millions of people who work there, is this oppressive figure.
Yeah, well, look around the world and how many situations like that are there? You know, how many countries are ruled in that way? Mm. Probably more than are not. It's Dredd's Law exists, sadly.
Ian, you were talking about how satire is an effective tool in comics, and indeed the first graphic novel, and hopefully first of many, that you wrote, Dark Entries, sees John Constantine entering the Big Brother house. So I guess, you know, you've got some satire right there, because perhaps I'm not the only person who has thought watching Big Brother or these other kind of reality shows, this would be far more entertaining if there was a monster or a serial killer in the house.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. They're not all going to make it out alive. I mean, that was it. That was what appealed to me, was you've got this closed set that's under 24-hour surveillance. How can people be disappearing or being bumped off? What is going on? And you think it's some kind of poltergeist activity. So, of course, you call for John to come in and enter the house, apparently as a new housemate, but actually looking to see, you know, what's going on. And then, spoiler alert, turns out the whole thing's happening in hell for the entertainment of the folk that are trapped in hell. And he's got to try and get out again. I love the idea of it. A Vertigo approached me, it was a long time ago now, and they said, from all the interviews you've done, we know that you're a big fan of comic books and always have been. We're going to do this new series called Vertigo Crime. You can bring us a brand new story, or you can use one of our existing characters. And I was desperate to write about Constantine because right from his first appearance in Swamp Thing, I was I'm much more, as a fan of comics, I'm much more interested in humans than aliens. Mm. And he's such a flawed human being who also happens to be a private eye, who also happens to have, of course, a bit of the supernatural in him. Alan Moore had grabbed me from the get-go when he appeared in Swamp Thing, and then when Jaime Delano started the Hellblazer series, I just thought, wow, this is amazing stuff. And that idea of the gumshoe, mm-hmm. I was really interested in, but taking it a wee bit further, in a way that you couldn't do with something like the kind of Humphrey Bogart type figure. It's interesting that I'm sitting next to the man who also did the Bogeyman.
Yeah.
where we take that kind of the trope of the kind of Humphrey Bogart as the gumshoe kind of thing, as the kind of private eye figure, but actually then make it a guy who's escaped from a special hospital who just thinks he's Humphrey Bogart in one of those films. It's absolute genius. The Bogeyman, I remember when I first got it, I just couldn't help laughing. I think that first thing when he's naked at the bus stop in Glasgow, and there's a wee woman there with her shopping bags, and it's Bucket Moraine, and he's naked having escaped from the asylum, and she's going, "Oh, you're poor wee todger, you must be frozen." I go, this is going to go some interesting places, this story. Yeah. I love that. I like books that where you can actually see, you can see the bones of the inspiration, you know. And maybe in Judge Dredd, you can see it a wee bit with the kind of Clint Eastwood figure. In Robohunter is probably a wee bit of Blade Runner. But I just loved that. And I loved it about Constantine, that he was that kind of down-at-heel, tired, cynical gumshoe. But he was so much more, so much more. And that was always what appealed to me about the comics that I read.
Were you ever asked to come back and do more? Because a fellow Scots crime writer, Denise Mina, had a run on the comic.
Yeah, she did. She had a really good run on Hellblazer, and then she went off and did Girl with a Dragon Tattoo and stuff as well. I wasn't very interested in adapting other people's work. Mm. They said to me, Vertigo said right from the get-go, if you've got anything else, come back to us. And I never got anything else. Oh. So far, I haven't come back to them. I did a tiny wee comic for Mark Miller for a short run thing he did called Clint, that he sort of put together with Jonathan Ross. And you know why they called it Clint, obviously. it's the one name you're not supposed to use in comics because of how it looks when it's written on the page. How it can be misconstrued as a capital letter. So that's why they called their comic Clint. And I did one for him, and I've done a couple of other wee bits and pieces. And worked on this one. Rory Gallagher, the blues guitarist, rock guitarist Rory Gallagher, was a huge fan of pulp and crime and thrillers. And his brother, to keep his legacy alive, said, I'm going to put together a compilation album of all these songs that he did that were influenced by Dashiell Hammett and various other writers. And he got me to do a short story set in the 1930s in LA. And then he got Tim Truman to do the art to go with it. And this is the cover of the album. And it was just brilliant fun. And we got Aidan Quinn, the actor, to narrate the story and stuff. And it was a lovely package. And I think it was very true to the things that Rory Gallagher was passionate about.
Have you ever considered doing something for 2000 AD?
No. No, but
if
then,
you were asked, would you?
Well, yeah, they've not asked yet, so there
I'm
you
sure
go.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
If Matt Smith is listening.
Yeah.
I'll mention it to him. I'm sure he'll love something.
Well, I mean, as an ex-editor of 2000 AD, David Bishop, I see him almost every day because he teaches at Napier University in Edinburgh. And so I see him in the cafe because I live around the corner from Napier. Pretty much every day we bump into each other. And we have some interesting conversations about comics. That's a creative writing course that actually specialises in genre and comics and stuff. So it's a because creative writing, it used to be really snooty at universities, you know. You want to be the next Ian McEwan or the next Martin Amis or something. And now they've gone, well, what if you don't? What if you actually want to be a commercial writer? And so they're focusing on that, which I think was a really I wish it had been around when I was young. You know, I mean, this is the thing, living in a working class coal mine in town in Fife, you want to be a writer, you went, how do I do it? There's no classes, I don't know anybody who's a writer, I don't know how to go about this. I wouldn't have not had the first idea how to send these cartoons off into the wilderness, or these little bits of writing I was doing. It was only when I got to Edinburgh University that I started to meet other people who were interested in being writers, and we started to work out how we could get a toehold in that industry.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'd known you could just go up and chap on the door of DC Thompson, I would have done it. But I didn't. Dundee was a mystery to me. You know, it was a mysterious place on the other side of the water. So I never went near Dundee. And I've stuck to that as a rule of thumb.
John, Ian mentioned The Bogeyman, and that's obviously one of your comics where, like he said, the influences are at large, the kind of noir characters played by Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
In terms of those kind of noir influences and other kind of crime narratives, what sort of stories did you enjoy as a writer that perhaps reflected in your work?
Well, I think a lot of that was based after Al and I did a Robert McKee course where he focuses a lot on Casablanca. And I don't know whether it was before or after, but a lot of it was based around Casablanca. And I mean, it's such a good film, it's really interesting to play off it, and you get a lot of material out of it. And it was also, there weren't many comics about Scotland, and we wanted to do one. And influenced by John McShane, who then ran ACCA Books and Comics, we wanted to produce something that was... We did use the story, use the character in an Eagle story, and we thought, this is too good to waste. So we withdrew the story and held it back and created the Bogeyman out of that.
And obviously, you know, crime is a constant feature in a strip like Dread, but thinking of other stories that you've written that are more fully kind of located within the crime drama, I'm a big fan of both History of Violence in its dreadful movie edition, which we have here. I can't believe that they would release a comic with no images on the outside cover, but we'll skip over that.
Well, on the third cover, they actually used an image from the movie that isn't in the book.
Brilliant. The History of Violence and The Button Man that we have on screen, both of which, compared to perhaps the more surrealistic, more satirical violence that you see in Dread, are far more about the devastating impact of real-life violence. That was obviously a subject you wanted
to tackle. It was a change for me to write something with that kind of realism. I really enjoyed it, especially Button Man as well. When you're writing fantasy, part of the trouble is that there aren't any rules. And it's interesting to write something where the rules are all laid out. There are certain possibilities, you can't just suddenly grow a pair of wings or whatever and get out of a situation. All the rules, you know them. It's life. And that was really interesting to write about that.
I mean, we're you know, John's sitting here in part because Ed Brubaker couldn't make it for personal reasons. But, you know, looking at what's happening in comics just now, people like him and Sean Phillips and doing stuff like Criminal and Fatale to a certain extent. And there's a kind of whole stream of kind of Gotham set crime stories, and they're proper crime stories. They go back to the kind of roots of noir and the roots of film noir and the roots of American kind of pulp fiction, pulp novels. And I think that's really exciting, especially when you see them brought up to date. It's a really great Christa Faust one just now called Peepland, which is set, I mean, it's basically, it's set in the world of strip shows and peep shows and all that in central New York towards the end of the 20th century. But it's got this great sense of kind of lives that are going nowhere. Mm. And that sense you always must get in noir that this is not going to end well. No matter how much hope you bring along during the course of the story, this just ain't going to end well. And which is kind of slightly depressing, but then you go, yeah, that kind of is real life for most of us. You know, life doesn't end well for any of us. Spoiler alert. But I just love that. I love that idea that everybody's doomed, but we can enjoy the ride.
Allowing for your marriage vows to happen to hold to put up with my subscription to the Galaxy's Greatest Comic, how large is your comic collection?
You know what? I mean, I lost a lot of them for a while. I mean, all my early ones when I was a kid got thrown out when I left at home, or my sister gave them to her pals or whatever. They all went. All the early 2000 ADs and the Victors and the Hotspurs and everything else and the various American comics costing sixpence all went. And I did have a fairly big collection, and then, you know, during various moves I thought I'd lost them. Then I found them in a trunk or in a box, which was exciting. But I'm afraid some of them have had to be winnowed out because we're downsizing next year. My wife and I are downsizing from a big house to a small flat. And so the charity shops of Edinburgh at the moment are awash with some of my comics. Some of them, of course, you can't bear. You're never going to give them away. And some of them you go, I can always read that digitally. If I really want to reread it, I can get it. I can reread it. So it's just taking up a lot of space. But I know a lot of you in the audience go, and it's been a horrible few months for me. I had to get rid of a lot of my books, a lot of my LPs and CDs, and just, you know, various paraphernalia. Manuscripts and stuff are all going to the National Library of Scotland, so they're safe. But there's a bunch of stuff I could never give away. The Alan Moores, the Delanos, the Bogeyman, you know, that are all sitting there. The early Neil Gaiman's. Neil Gaiman I'd forgotten until I was thinking about this event, but I mean, was it his first book, Violent Cases? Yeah. It was definitely Dave McKean's first.
Yeah.
Was a crime story. I mean, it was about Al Capone. Doesn't get much more crime than that, you know. And a lot of people, you know, when you go back to their early works, you find that there's a lot of crime, you know, in the margins or at the back of what they're doing.
Mm. Ian has previously talked about how Edinburgh is a big influence on him as a creator, you know, the possibilities of the city. Are there any locations, John, that have particularly kind of inspired you as a writer?
No, I can't say there are. New York, probably. Mm. It's such an exciting city. So much goes on there. But no, most of my stuff is set in this unknown future, which doesn't particularly have any bearing on any particular place.
Mm. Having said which, The Bogeyman is a great novel about Glasgow.
Oh, yes, yeah, it certainly was. It was our intention to make that as true to Glasgow as we could. The characters and the whole feel of
the language,
story.
The language.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the gritty black and white art too was. So yeah, you could say Glasgow.
I was chuckling away at it, going, I wonder what people reading this in America are going to make of this. You know, because some of the words are very particularly Scots, and I know the problem I've got with my novels, just trying to get them past an editor in London. He'll say, what does hee-haw mean? You know, and I'll go, well, it's Scots rhyming slang for fuck all. Oh, right, okay. You know, I don't think we can use that, Ian. You know, and in America, then they change it again. In America, when I'll get the books back from the States, and they'll have changed it so Rebus is walking down the sidewalk to open the trunk of his car.
Oh, dear.
You know, and it's just, you go, that's just horrible. Mm. And then American fans come to Edinburgh looking for Rebus's Edinburgh, and they can't find it, you know, because Flesh Market Close, which is a real street, has been changed in America to Flesh Market Alley. And they go, "What? Why did you change it?" And I go, because publishers think you're idiots, basically. And I mean, readers aren't idiots. Readers are the opposite of idiots. That's why they're readers. And they want all these cultural nuances, and they want to have to work a wee bit to find out what this all means. Mm. I think my favourite one recently, though, was, and this is often a terrible tangent, but I got back a Rebus novel that had been translated into French, and what they do in France is if they don't understand a cultural reference, they keep it in the original language and put a wee footnote to explain it to the reader in French. And it was Rebus saying to somebody, I get the feeling we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. Which is a line from quite a well-known film, I would suggest. Footnote, down at the bottom. And in French it says, Rebus here is referring to the two American AOR bands, Kansas and Toto.
That's amazing.
Which made no sense at all when you tried to go back and put it in the context. you know, one phone call to me, one email to me would have fixed that. But.
Well, in a good story anyway, I mean, if the reader doesn't get the cultural references, then as long as you can follow the story, all it does is actually kind of suggest to you this kind of alien environment that is intriguing, you know. Mm. I think, you know, if you're thinking of, say, Glasgow in The Bogeyman, then it is that whole fish out of water scenario that actually makes it so appealing. A guy who thinks that he's Humphrey Bogart and adopts that kind of manner of speech and mannerisms when he's surrounded by typical Glaswegians.
Well, I think we did include a glossary in that.
Did you? Just for readers south of the border. Yeah. I mean, I've just been dissing the French, and I should apologise, because they've been very good, especially with comics. I moved to France in 1990 and lived there for 6 years full time, and every supermarket was full of Bon Désiné. Mm-hmm. And they were just passionate about comics, and adults thought nothing of reading comics. They weren't embarrassed about reading comics, and they also took on a lot of American, right? They loved American pulp fiction and American noir, and not only did they translate those books, but a lot of their comic books then reflected that. A lot of French comics at that time and now were heavily influenced by noir. And they also did adaptations of American writers. Mm. And so you can get a Lawrence Bloch crime novel adapted as a comic book, but it'll have been done by a French writer and a French artist. Mm. I just think that was really thrilling. And when you go to when you go to a French crime writers convention or crime fiction convention, the crossover with comics is extraordinary. Mm. You know, there'll be comics people there, there'll be creators there. There's just the lines have blurred. You know, in a way that still hasn't happened with comics in the UK. I'm going to the Cheltenham Literary Festival tonight. I doubt there'll be too many comics creators there on stage. No.
Yeah.
You know?
There's always been that divide.
Always. I know, in the UK. I mean, even for crime writers, for years you'd go to a literary festival, there'd be no crime writers. And if there were, there'd be two or three crime writers on one panel pushed to a corner. Wee bit of apartheid over here. And it's lovely that those barriers are beginning to break down in the UK, but we've got a ways to go.
Yeah. But that said, you know, the idea of comics is a slightly illegitimate genre, where it's something that you're almost not meant to talk about or indulge in as an adult. Is that something that's appealed to both of you?
It's one of the oldest genres, I think. I mean, cavemen were drawing comics. It's as valid as any other to me. I don't see the difference between comics, film, art. I mean, they're all forms of art. Mm. And none is better than the other.
Yeah,
I think sometimes it's to do with the practitioners in each thing. You know, if you get bad comics, then you get a bad impression of comics. But there are so many good ones now, intelligent ones, and a far greater range of subjects. I mean, before the British invasion of the States, they were so centred on superheroes. And I think the Brits sort of opened that up a bit for them.
Yeah, and the barriers are breaking down everywhere. So that I mentioned Krista Faust. Krista Faust is an American crime novelist, but she's also starting to write comics. Denise Minor, you've mentioned already, novelist, but loves comics, loved reading them, and then also writes them. And it is Lauren Bucus, who's a South African fantasy writer and crime writer, has also started to write comics. And it's not because they're just looking for something different, it's because they're passionate about the genre, they're passionate about the form, and there's a way of telling a story graphically that you can't ever get when you're doing a novel or a short story. And it's nice sometimes to work collaboratively, because if you're a novelist, it's a very, not lonely occupation, but it's a solitary occupation. And sometimes when you're working with somebody else, an artist, and you're bouncing ideas off them and you're having a conversation, I got something similar recently. I did a Rebus stage play. It's on in Edinburgh just now, and then touring widely. But I did it collaboratively with a playwright, and she would say, "Look, Ian, you're used to having as many scenes as you need, as many pages as you need, as many characters as you need. We can't do that on the stage. So you just got to get that out of your head. And this story is going to have to be told in dialogue. This story cannot be told narratively. It's got to be told in dialogue. So we had to find a new story involving Rebus that was specifically for the stage. But that made me think out of the box. Yeah. And that was the lovely thing about being asked to do a graphic novel. Having had no training. I mean, you know, it's a huge privilege to be told, go away and do a graphic novel, without having to have earned the right to do it, by getting a lot of stuff rejected down the years and learning your craft. And I made a lot of mistakes early on in that. And when I did the first graphic novel, I made a lot of, you know, I put in far too much, it was too consec- executive. It was like if somebody's opening a door and going in, they'd be a close-up of the hand on the door, the door opening, the other side of the door, people watching them. And it would take us like six panels to get somebody to walk in somewhere.
Well, that's just more like manga.
Yeah, I know. But I thought, no, you've only got so many pages and you can't get away with that. And so we did start to kind of self-edit. And that's really useful as a writer to remember that, you know, that brevity is all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something that your scripts have always been described as, John. I think someone said once that reading a script of yours was like getting a very exciting telegram. But I guess that's nice because it means that it's more like a filmic relationship, that you're writing a script and then you're leaving the direction, the art direction, the casting, all of that to the artist.
Very much. A lot of it's down to sheer laziness, of course. I don't like to write two sentences and one will do. Sometimes I don't even write a description. I just say, read the dialogue. And a good artist, why do you have to tell him what's going on when he can see it? So I've always been lucky, or of recent years, lucky to work with really good artists. And I know I can rely on them to fill in what lack of imagination I have with theirs. And so I do rely on them a lot. You know, I think of stories in terms of conversations and character interactions. And I leave the great visuals to the great artists that I work with.
Mm. I mean, I didn't actually meet any comic book writers or illustrators until after I'd done my first graphic novel. And the only tip, the only thing I had before I started writing the first script was I had the special edition of Watchmen, and that had a kind of few pages of Alan Moore's script. Yeah, apparently that's not typical in the comic book. You know, it was for panel one of Watchmen. It was like a page and a half of detailed analysis of what he wanted the artist to do, and so that was what my script was like to start with. And I sent the first few pages off to Vertigo, and I went, "Dear Christ, no! Let's free the artist up a wee bit here. You don't have to put in nearly that amount of detail." And then I got to meet writers and artists, and you know, they'd say, "Oh yeah, you just go blam." That's all you need, just blam and let the artist decide what they're going to do with that.
Yeah.
And a wee bit like the exciting telegram. But as a novelist, of course, I'm used to writing screeds. Mm. You know?
Well, at the risk of adding two and two together and coming up with five, and again, this is based on my reading Rankin on Rebus, in that you talk about, A, how Jekyll and Hyde was a particular favourite novel of yours growing up, and then as a teenager, you mentioned coming up with an alter ego as a prog rock star, you know, in your head, and also when you were writing poetry, apparently you had a kind of like an avatar when you were writing those. And comics, particularly American superhero comics, are all about an alternative secret identity. So I was wondering if that was something about the medium that appealed to you.
Yeah, probably. I mean, a secret identity, definitely, because, you know, I arrived at Edinburgh University and started studying literature, and Scottish literature very quickly became apparent to me was about alter egos and doppelgangers and secret identities. Going back to Jekyll and Hyde, Jekyll and Hyde, written by Robert Louis Stevenson, born and brought up in Edinburgh, and living in these two cities, living in the city of the Enlightenment, the new town, with a kind of rational family who were all scientists and are... they designed lighthouses and stuff, and he was going to be a lawyer. But he was attracted to the darker side of Edinburgh, the old town, where all the vagabonds, prostitutes and junkies hung out. So he would tiptoe up the hill towards the old town at dead of night as a teenager, and then tiptoe back, living in those two worlds. And that book, Jekyll and Hyde, was also heavily influenced by two things, really. One, well, more than that, but let's focus on two. One was a real-life character called William Brodie, who was an Edinburgh resident, gentleman by day, deacon of rights, a cabinet maker, etc., etc. By night had a gang, and he would break into your house, which he did with facility because he had fitted the lock. He would break into your house, and he was eventually hanged on a scaffold that he had made himself for his crimes. So gentleman by day, thief by night, good and evil incarnate in the same person. And in Stevenson's childhood bedroom, and it's now in the Writers Museum in Edinburgh, you can go and see it, was a wardrobe built by Deacon William Brodie. Hmm. And Stevenson's nursemaid would tell him the story of this guy who was good and evil. So that must have got hardwired into his head, and then years later came out. But another influence on Stevenson was a book called Confessions of a Justified Sinner, which is the first serial killer novel, as far as I'm aware. It's about a religious zealot, a young man who's introduced or who meets one day a charismatic stranger who seems to be a shapeshifter. Who tells him that because he's a member of the elect and is going to go to heaven no matter what he does, he can kill people on earth. especially to disagree with his religion. So it's like a kind of, it's like a bomber, you know, it's like a terrorist bomber has been set adrift, has been set free to go out and kill anybody who disagrees with his religion. And you're never sure if the shapeshifter is the devil, a minor kind of devil, whether it's a figment of his fevered imagination, or whether it's just a real psychopath, a charismatic psychopath. You're never entirely sure because it's such a weird narrative. It's a really difficult book to read. So all of that was drip feeding into me, and then taking me up to the more present day when you've got somebody like Miss Jean Brodie in Muriel Spark's Prime Miss Jean Brodie, who seems a very she's actually related to Deacon William Brodie. She says it herself in the book. And you're never sure if she's the hero or the villain of that story, because she seems to be a little bit of both. And so all of these kind of people that are seem to be one thing but might be another. So the secret identity, the Batman, the all this kind of stuff really did appeal to me. And Doctor Who appealed to me. Just kept changing, you know, from one year to the next or one series to the next, played by a different actor, going to different places, taking on different personalities, dressing differently to blend in with the locals at whatever period in history happens to arrive. All of that was, you know, for someone like me who was a shapeshifter, I think all writers are and all novelists are, but living in Cardenden, I'd be writing poems to girls I couldn't talk to and then keeping them under the bed and then going and hanging around the street corner with the Doc Martens and the Harrington jacket pretending to be tough. And then when the local Neds all went off to fight the next village along, we were called YCD, Young Cardenden. They were called the YLM, the Young Lochiele Mental. And they were much harder than us. So when they all went off to fight each other, I would say, I've just got to go home. And I'd go home and write about it in my bedroom and then tuck it under the bed again where my mum couldn't find it. So there was that kind of secret Ian. There was that doppelganger already there. And if I'd gone out to the streets of Cardenden and said, by the way, folks, I'm writing poetry, I would have been beaten to a pulp. You know, I didn't even tell my parents that was writing, because I thought they wouldn't understand.
I mean, I guess conversely, in your work, John, you've not really dealt with characters. I mean, you've written, you know, some superhero stuff, but people like Dredd, like the Button Man, like Johnny Alpha, they're very much characters whose identity is on their sleeve. But at the same time, you kind of get to explore their psychological identity.
Yeah. Dredd, not for a long while before he got into his head a bit, but...
tight boots.
tight boots, yes. They're on the surface, they're just hard men, but underneath there's another side to them. Usually a more violent side. it's interesting exploring that and working your way through it and finding out about them as you write it. And like, I didn't know Dredd, really. I still don't completely know him. But, you know, as I write him and explore his deeper feelings as far as they go, I get to know him better. Johnny Alpha, he's much more my kind of... I understand him better, the kind of morose guy with the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's interesting. And Button Man is just a sheer psychopath with a nice side.
But I mean, the history of violence is quite a complex portrait of a man's interior life. I mean, do you remember where you got the idea for that, where that came from?
Oh, I think it's dry rot in the house. It's totally miserable, carrying it out to burn it. And suddenly just the idea came to me. I don't know what the relationship was, but that's when it happened. Just that little germ of an idea, a man who'd been hiding out for so long, hiding his past. And the one little thing, a missing finger, that gave it away. I'm into missing fingers. You'll find them in Button Man as well. They're sort of handy marker. The whole hidden side of the hero, they changed his name in the film, but the whole hidden side of McKenna was very interesting in the way it all came out. I wish they hadn't changed the third act. I think they felt it was probably too violent. There was the film, I really enjoyed the film, but the third act was a tonal change that I thought was wrong. It was very funny, but the change in tone just didn't go with the first two acts of the story, which was a pity.
I mean, I was really, I mean, you know, as a crime writer, of course, I'm fascinated in why human beings do terrible things to each other. And that's what all crime fiction is predicated on, is that very basic question. And it comes back to good and evil a lot. And so I'm fascinated by especially men of violence or men who've had violent pasts who do try and, you know, I mean, I know guys have come out of jail, murderers have come out of jail and are trying to rebuild their lives. And there's always that, there's always going to be somebody there in a pub who wants to have a go at you to prove that they're bigger and tougher than you, especially if you've been jailed for an act of violence or whatever. And it's, you know, how these people change and does society allow them to change is an absolutely fascinating question. I spent a few months, a long time ago, making a series for Channel 4, and it was meant to be about crime and punishment, but we got into much more basic questions and ended up being about evil. It was called Ian Rankin's Evil Thoughts. We used to go to check-in desks at airlines, and there would be my folder going, Ian Rankin's Evil. And I'd say, I'm Ian Rankin, I'm checking in, please. And it was just weird. But during the course of that series, I got to go to death row in Texas, interview a guy who was waiting to be executed. I spoke to his victim's daughter. I spoke to the mother of a woman that had been murdered in England. I spoke to a guy that had arrested a serial killer in London. I was exorcised by the chief exorcist of the Diocese of Rome. I didn't know that was going to happen, but I thought it was going to be an interview. But anyway, it was fine.
Once did he get rid of your evil thoughts?
Well, once he got me off the ceiling and wiped a ball off my face, I was tip-top, man, I'll tell you. But at the end of that series, sorry, it's a long answer, but at the end of that series, I wasn't much further forward in pointing to an individual and saying, you're irredeemably evil. But I could point to an action, and say, at the point at which you carried out that act, you were performing an act of evil. But I still do believe in redemption.
Yeah.
I think it's tough if you don't, you know? And I think it comes across in a lot of the comics that are being written now, is it can be a hard road, but there usually is redemption waiting at the end of it.
We've got about 10 minutes left, so does anyone have any questions either for John or Ian?
John.
I've got a question. You were talking about the crossover between comics and crime novels. I was wondering if either of you have read the work of Greg Rucka, who obviously started life as a crime novelist, and he's now written, obviously he's written, writing comics for a long time. I just wonder what your thoughts are. I think he's a great writer in both medium, but I just...
I've read some Greg Rucka, but I've not read him for a wee while, and I've read both the crime stuff and his comics, and he is a great writer. I mean, I think, you know, the thing about crime fiction is it tends to be, these are commercial storytellers. We're not being propped up by the state, we're not being propped up by the Arts Council or anything else. If nobody buys our stuff, we're not making a living. So we are commercial writers. And so we get in straight away, and we grab you, and we don't let you go because we want you to buy this story. And you know, there's a lot of comic books are great at storytelling. I mean, it's all about great stories. I always say that I could never do it. I couldn't do what somebody like Denise or Greg did. I couldn't keep writing a continuing comic. Too many, I mean, how do you get ideas all the time? How could you keep doing 2000 AD every week?
Just Kim.
You know, drugs. I think it must be drugs.
No, let's not mention those.
I mean, Lemsip, obviously, John.
Well, it is difficult. It's good to have a break from it and let other people come in and well, like on Dread, it's quite interesting to see other people's take on it, not just mine. It broadens the story, it gives it more depth. Sometimes it ruins it, but, you know, it adds... Generally, the good writers that have worked on it have added to the story, and that's interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's a moot point, actually, Joe, because I was just thinking about that. I mean, I can think of plenty of novelists who are now turning to comic books. I'm trying to think of comic book writers who are now turning to novels, and there aren't that
many. Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, Neil Gaiman, I suppose. Yeah. But it seems to be, at the moment, it's mostly one-way traffic, but in a good way.
I think if Dread had been just more linear, it would have been much more difficult to sustain it. But you've got the city and all the weird characters in it, and there's always a different story to be told. So that's why that's easy. And Strontium Dog, it's harder to come up with continuing stories on.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, with when you've got Mega City 1, you've got a million stories.
That was the Naked City.
It was the Naked City, yeah. Eight million stories in the Naked City, yeah.
Any other questions?
I'm sure you've been asked this before, but what is it about Scotland that produces so many great comic and crime writers?
What is it about Scotland that produces so many great comic writers and crime writers? I don't know, maybe they put something in the water. I come from Fife, which is a tiny wee bit of Scotland, but we've produced any number of great writers, and not only writers, but actors, musicians, you name it. We think we're part of some weird experiment, some kind of X-Files type experiment that's been done on us when we were kids. We were all injected with something to try and make us creative. I don't know. I think there's a storytelling culture I mean, you know, my parents didn't read books, but my dad told stories all the time. When I was a wee kid, I would get into bed with my parents on a Sunday morning, and he would just riff. He'd just riff on us, make up a story, and you just get used to it. You get hardwired for storytelling, and also, you know, if you were working class in Scotland, there was that sense that you could just get on with it. And in fact, I was lucky. I grew up at a time of punk. Punk was a huge influence on a lot of us because punk said you don't have to have gone to the right schools. You don't have be able to afford this or afford that. You just, if you want to do something, get out there and give it a go. And a bunch of us, you know, tried everything we could, writing for plays and writing, you know, acting, you name it. A whole bunch of us from that generation just went off and tried. And some made it and some didn't.
There are an awful lot of good Scots artists as well. It's not just writers. Yeah. The comic world is full of good Scots artists. I don't know why. I think the Scots basically are a fairly intelligent race. If I compare it to, like, growing up in America, the basic level of intelligence there is much lower than in Scotland.
Not planning to get more jobs in America.
No, he's gone, he's gone.
Just one more trip and that's it.
And maybe it's a DC Thompson thing as well. I mean, you know, all those DC Thompson comics that are Scottish. Just below the surface, they were very Scottish. The humour and Oor Willie and the Bruins and all that kind of stuff were in your face Scots. And so that, you know, we thought people are telling stories about us from the get go. People are telling stories about us. They must share our concerns and everything else. So that might be something to do with it. It's really interesting. There's also made a big games industry in Scotland just now, which all comes out of the fact that Timex watches were made in Dundee. And Timex had a factory in Dundee, and when Timex went digital, all the parents who worked in the Timex factory got very digital literate and passed it on to their kids. And their kids, when they went to uni, all started doing digital computing courses. And then they started the first digital computer games course in the UK. It was in Abertay University. And they all went off and started companies like Rockstar. Mm. They all came out of that, and they all came out of the fact that Timex watches were made in Dundee.
Any other questions? Yeah.
I think you both touched on being true to the constraints of the real world and telling quaint stories. I'm just interested to know what role does maybe some research play in that, how you tend to approach it.
You ever do research, John?
Now and then. Depending on what it is, but I don't do much. My research tends to be keeping up with the news, reading the newspapers, seeing what's going on in the world and extrapolating that into the future. People like Pat Mills is a big research man. Like, he couldn't have written Charlie's War without doing an immense amount of research, and it shows in the story. But once again, my laziness comes in. I prefer to wing it when I can.
Yeah.
But I imagine you have to do quite a lot.
Well, I mean, you know, that thing, that basic creative writing course thing, say, write about what you know, that would be lethal for me, because I don't really know anything. And, I mean, my first book that I ever published, The Flood, was about the town I grew up in, and that was, you know, I couldn't go back home after that, because nobody liked what I said about the place. And I think that's where Rebus came from, was that defence mechanism of writing about a guy who nobody could see me and him at the start of the series. Didn't know it was going to be a series. But yeah, I mean, the research was basically walking around Edinburgh for me, at the start of the Rebus series, and then trying to make sense of the place. And to make sense of the place, I wanted to write about it. And I thought, oh, I'm going to write a crime novel. And I was a PhD student. And I thought, how do I don't know any cops. And I wrote to the chief of police and said, can you help? And he sent me to Leith Police Station to talk to two detectives. And I had a bunch of questions for them. And they said, well, what's your book about? I said, well, it's about these kids that are being murdered. And all that. And went, all right. And they went away for a wee chat and they came back. Now, I didn't realise that there was a crime almost identical to this was actually ongoing in Scotland.
Did they think that you were confessing?
They said, we've had a really good idea, Mr.
Rankin.
Want to
speak to you, Ian.
Yeah, we had a great idea. Why don't we pretend that you're a suspect in an ongoing police inquiry? So they took me to an interview room and interviewed me and put it all into the computer. And I'm writing it all down going, this is brilliant, guys. This is fantastic. I found out later on I was a suspect in a murder inquiry involving seven children. I don't think I was a suspect for very long. But that put me off doing research for a while. Perfectly honest with you. And I did make quite a few mistakes in the books because of that, the police procedure, and also procedure keeps changing. You write it in the book, it gets published the next year, by then it's all changed anyway. It's really frustrating. The most frustrating thing for me is, of course, technology changes much quicker than I can keep up with it. And so, you know, something I'm writing about this year will be redundant. But I went back and read one of the early Rebus books, and he's not got a computer in his house, no mobile phones, the fax machine is a little god sitting in a corner of the office. If he wants to make a phone call, he goes out and finds a working phone box. That's it. And now, as a crime writer, I'm always having to deal with a mobile phone. Yeah. Somebody's being kidnapped. Hello, I'm being kidnapped. Yeah, I'll just put my GPS on and you can come and get me. You've got to deal with that. Mm. You know, film is even worse. Film and TV, they've, you know, no signal, battery dead. Mm. You've got to get rid of the phone.
There are no mobile phones in the early Dread either. I look
in
back
the future,
and I think,
yeah.
How could that be? But research is something that you tend to do when you have to. Like if you come upon a storyline and you need a virus, say, that will affect a human being in a certain way, well, you start researching that. What could I use? Or sometimes you read about a virus and you include it in your story, or you read about a certain weapon or a certain psychological tick in somebody and you incorporate that in your story. But research tends to be, for me anyway, when I'm faced with a problem, that's when I start looking for a solution. But otherwise, I just wing it.
Sage advice for everyone.
Wing it.
John and Ian, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
For more information about Ian Rankin's work, you can find him at ianrankin.net. That's IANRANKIN.net. And on Twitter under the handle BeatHHigh. A huge number of John Wagner's Judge Dredd strips for 2000 AD can be found at 2000ad.com and bought in graphic novel or digital download format. And the Lakes International Comic Art Festival, where my Q&A with Ian and John was recorded, can be found at comicartfestival.com. And the next LICAF will be taking place on the 11th to the 13th of October 2019. In the second half of this evening's show, I'm talking to American writer Brian Azzarello. Brian is probably best known for his long-form comic 100 Bullets, and has also contributed to such ongoing titles as Hellblazer, Superman, and Wonder Woman. In my interview with Brian that you're about to hear, we're concentrating on his genre work, and so looking at 100 Bullets, as well as his recent work on Batman comics, including the controversial Batman Damned. While I tried to find a quiet corner at the MCM Comic Con, where my interview with Brian was recorded, unfortunately this proved pretty impossible, so you'll have to forgive the background noise. You've been working in comics a little over 20 years now. And, sorry, you might not notice. And you started off doing as much editing for the smaller companies as you did writing. Was that with an eye to becoming a writer, or were you not kind of that bothered about what career you might have had in the comics industry to start off?
I really wasn't doing any editing.
Oh, right, okay, you're credited as editor on credited. Comics from Comico.
Yes, I was credited. I was more of a... I was a cat wrangler, is what I was.
Okay.
I was not an editor. Don't know. I mean, did I even intend to be a comic book writer? No. It just sort of happened.
Mm. So,
I'm like everybody else in the world, okay? This is not what I wanted to be.
Okay. Presumably, once you started getting good reviews, even for your early work, you must have thought, oh, maybe I have found my niche, my, you know, way of expressing myself.
Once I was making money at it, and then I got rehired, I was like, oh, keep it this.
Mm.
It was one of those things, like, before doing this, I'd had a variety of jobs. None of them lasted longer than 5 years. I was just, like, moving around and stuff. So.
I read somewhere that you got your break at DC because your wife, perhaps wife-to-be at that point, read a werewolf story that you'd written and thought you'd be a good fit at Vertigo.
I don't know about that. That's much more romantic than what really happened.
Okay.
I met an editor there, Lou Stathis. I was familiar with Lou from Reflex magazine and High Times, where he was working on these lifestyle kind of, like, Reflex was like a skater kind of music magazine. Then he got a job at Vertigo, and I knew him from the other places, and we were talking, and he's like, why don't you pitch me something? And he told me what he didn't want. He goes, like, I don't want this. And then that's what I ended up pitching him. I didn't get the job, but we kept at it.
Because, I mean, I think it's really interesting that your kind of first epic work, 100 Bullets, was pretty early in your career. You'd only done Johnny Double before that.
Yeah.
And then you get to do this 100-issue kind of epic. I mean, presumably when you started that, it wasn't with the knowledge that you would necessarily be able to do the full story that you wanted to.
No, it wasn't. The first contract was for just a year. It was 12 issues.
Okay.
And when we were signing it, and they said, like, well, if this doesn't go well, you think you can wrap it up in 18 issues, the story? Okay. And I said, yeah, sure. I was lying. I would have just, the same as Loveless. When Loveless ended, it ended. Karen said, so we're going to cancel Loveless. She says, well, we'll give you 6 issues to wrap it up. And I'm like, no, it's done where it is.
Okay, leave it with a cliffhanger.
Just leave it where, no, it's like, it's canceled. It's like, all right, so is my enthusiasm, Karen.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, it's like, you obviously moving on, so I'm going to move on too.
Okay. But looking at the work you have done, even though you've worked with superheroes like Batman and Wonder Woman, it seems that...
I wouldn't say I've worked with them.
Well, I was going to say...
I've worked against them.
Well, I was going to say, it feels like you have an interest in working in a certain kind of genre, whether it's crime or mythology, and then perhaps the superheroes fit around, the kind of story that you want to tell, rather than necessarily you thinking, I want to be a Batman writer or I want to be a Wonder Woman writer.
Never thought I was going to... I've never thought I want to be a Batman writer or a Wonder Woman writer. But if I don't have something to say about the character, I'm not going to write this story. I don't know. I think when you read books that are especially comics, you can read how bored the people are working on them. It comes through. They might not think that it does, but it comes through. I don't think you read a book of mine and think that I was bored doing it.
No, indeed. So do you approach these projects from a sense of genre then, perhaps?
Somewhat. I suppose that's why, other than Superman, that's the only one that I think I've done that I would consider superhero genre. Because superheroes are a genre unto themselves. So yeah, I guess I do. It's like, can I tell this story? Like, what do I have to say about Wonder Woman? It's like, this is what I have to say about it. And it's going to take me 3 years. So I pitched the whole thing at once. Which is why we were able to sort of work outside of the New 52 when they were doing all those
reboots
or crossovers and all that stuff. And it's like, nah, we didn't have to do any of them. She and Superman never kissed. He was not her boyfriend in my book.
But
I still disagree with that.
Do you think yourself as much a crime writer as a superhero writer?
I'm a comic book writer.
Okay.
Maybe there was one point in my life where it's like, yes, you're a crime writer. It's like, but now, what do? I make my living writing comic books. That's great. So I'm a comic book writer. It just so happens that I bring my own sort of sensibilities into comics,
What would you say shaped those sensibilities?
What shaped them?
Yeah, in terms of the stories you want to tell, the kind of human stories that you want to tell on the page.
Oh my God, trying to make up for all the mistakes I've made. That's what shapes everything I do. Yeah, making up for mistakes.
Well, I mean, it's funny you should say that, though, because kind of the theme of 100 Bullets, for example, is people having some kind of traumatic event that they feel that they can fix with a bullet, and then obviously the story deals with how many different ways that can lead to a horrible consequence.
Yeah, but I think what makes us interesting and what is our mistakes. We're the sum of all the things we've done wrong. And we're always trying to, hopefully, we're always trying to overcome those. But that's what my stories are about.
Yeah.
Somebody makes a mistake, and they make a ton of other mistakes trying to fix the mistake that they made.
That's noir.
Yeah.
In a nutshell. But what makes a noir story, I think, different from any other story, genre-wise, is the character, the protagonist, is in a worse place than they were when the story started.
Okay.
Most other stories, it's like, oh, you overcome this tragedy. Mm. Or, no, the tragedy eventually takes you down. That's what a sunny disposition.
Well, I was going to say, you generally seem like quite a cheerful person, and yet there obviously is this theme of pessimism in your work.
Yeah, well, I don't know which is real. Is it my, you know, I'm crying on the inside.
And then more recently, you've mixed the Western with kind of like werewolf fiction in Moonshine. When you're thinking of doing a project like that, is it because you think this is a genre I'd like to have a go at?
I wouldn't consider Moonshine a Western. It's a crime story, so it's more...
Or gangster, I guess.
Gangster, yeah. With mixing up with the monster genre. And also, you know, the lead character is an alcoholic who's prone to blackouts, which just, like, fits into the werewolf sort of, you know, mythos perfectly. Mm. It's one of those things where when came up with the idea and the title, it's like, why hasn't anybody ever done this before? Mm. That happens to me every once in a while. I think, like, the story that Flashpoint Batman story that I did, where Bruce was the one who was killed in the alley. It's like, why didn't anybody think of this before?
Yeah.
But, I mean, and Loveless spun out of... I did a miniseries called El Diablo, which I really, really liked doing. And it was a Western, but it was really a crime story. So it was like, can we do a noir Western? Can we take these sensibilities and, you know, do a bigger series about it? So that's where Loveless came out.
You mentioned that Moonshine uses the metaphor of people having alcoholic blackouts and, you know, werewolf characters not remembering what they did when it was a full moon. Are those kind of the kernel ideas that you have when you think of developing a story?
Yes, or maybe I was hungover. yeah, it was what started. Well, actually, the alcoholism came in later.
Hmm.
When Moonshine was originally conceived, it was like, I'm trying to... I wanted to go with, like, classic kind of monster stories. So the werewolf one, it's like, what do we, you know... And then, like, I came up with the title, Moonshine. And it was like, oh, God, it's about moonshiners and there's a werewolf. So it's gangsters and werewolves. So it's just, you know, that kind of thing. And then it's like, you have to have the fish out of water. And the fish out of water is an alcoholic during Prohibition. And, you know, then it just sort of, those elements just sort of sprang up, you know. Mm. The ground was so fertile. All I had to do was pee on it.
You've worked with loads of different collaborators over the years. Someone like it. Okay.
You know, I tend to work with people over and over again.
Mm. Well, I mean, I was going to say, but someone like Eduardo Risso is someone that you return to from time to time. And when you have an artist who has a very distinct style, does that kind of dictate the kind of story that you think I'd like to work with him on the following?
Not so much.
Okay.
No. With Eduardo... We've done so many stories, but every time we do one, it's like, well, let's make sure it's not like the last one we did.
Mm.
You know, we keep playing around with the genre.
Mm.
Lee Bermejo and I, we tend to return to kind of the same gloomy place. You know what? When I work with Cliff Chang, those are happy books.
So there is then some kind of connection.
There is. Yeah. I don't think... All right. Of course, right now, because I've worked with him so much, I see stories as, and this won't make any sense, I see stories as Eduardo is doing them. And they're in my head and I'm writing them. It's like, oh, and then, you know, I get the page back and it's like, oh, that looks nothing like what I thought you were going to do, which is interesting. You know. And maybe, you know, but certainly with Lee, like, after a while, I learned the rhythms that artists like to tell stories with, and they, you know, they're different for everyone, but once they know their rhythm, it's like it makes things easier for me.
But also I wonder, it's kind of the materials they use as well. So Lee has this painterly style, and then someone like Eduardo has the really dramatic kind of hard blacks that are almost cartoony at times. So I wonder if that also kind of dictates the kind of story that certain artists can tell in terms of you being bringing out the best in them. And vice versa.
Yeah, you know? I don't know, because like I think that take, we brought it up, like the Flashpoint Batman story. Lee could have drawn that story.
Yeah.
You know? It would have been different, dramatically different, but that's the kind of story he could have drawn.
Mm.
So, I tend to... I get into the relationship while we're working. I don't think that it really affects the stories, other than like the stories that we have, you know, input along the way with each other.
Hmm. I guess I have to ask you this. Personally, I'm not that interested. People would be surprised if I didn't ask you about the fuss that there's been about Batman Damned. And I personally don't quite understand it myself. Because, you know, DC is still publishing comics about Dr. Manhattan, and no one ever complains about him being naked. And yet there's been this controversy with Batman Damned. Presumably it took you by surprise.
Yes, it did. And all I can say is Dr. Manhattan is no Batman, you know. He's one...
But do you think it's as much an American thing? Because, you know, in terms of, say, nudity in comics, in Europe there seems to be more of a laissez-faire attitude, while in America there still seems to be this idea that there are certain things you can depict and can't depict on the page. If you think of the number of books that have been banned in American libraries for content, you know, and you think, why on earth? I can't think of any reason why, but someone will find a reason.
Yes, but more than that, I'll say it again, it's Batman.
Okay. And there are certain lines.
There's certain lines you don't cross, and God, we found where that line was.
We
didn't know. I mean, the whole hoopla was not anything that we expected. I thought there were some other things in that book that would be considered controversial.
Mm.
But they were... No one has said anything about it other than, you know.
But secretly, I wonder if you don't mind the controversy, because there's nothing like bad press to make something sell out. And indeed, it has sold out everywhere.
Well, what I believe is inconsequential. I don't own Batman.
No, this is true. In terms of collaboration, we've talked about the way you work with different artists, but you've also created, worked on titles that are kind of set in and around other stories. For example, you wrote two of the Before Watchmen comics. Mm-hmm. Was that something that was a challenge in a way, because you knew you were kind of working in the marginalia of something that's considered a classic? So whatever you bring to it is either going to be controversial, or perhaps some people will think is inconsequential, because Watchmen is seen as this kind of like untouchable tome, and so whatever else you do,
it's touchable. I don't know, we tried to do the best job we could with those characters. I actually think Comedian came to me after Rorschach. Rorschach was what was offered.
Okay.
And I said, when they called me and said, like, do you want to do Rorschach? I'm like, you're kidding. And like, you're really going to do this? And it's like, yes, we're really going to do it. So, but we're offering this to you first. And they said, like, well, we've talked to Dave Gibbons, and we're going to, you know, talk to Alan. Not that that's going to do anything, but, you know. I'm like, okay, all right. And I'm thinking about Rorschach, and immediately Lee came to mind. So I guess it kind of speaks a little bit to what you were talking about before, but it was like Lee, Rorschach, oh God. And so I said to Dan DiDio, who was editor-in-chief at the time, I said, like, who do you have for an artist? And he goes, we don't have anybody. We're just, you know, looking for writers right now. I said, well, what about Lee? And he goes, if you can get Lee, and if Lee wants to do it, yes. So I said, okay. And I was having, you know, there was certainly some hesitancy to do it, because it was like, man, do I really need that controversy in my life? You know? And it's not, look, controversy is never anything I've ever shied away from. In fact, I think there's people that would consider what I do courting controversy. But anyway, I was hesitant. But I called Lee, and it's like, hey, Lee, they offered me Rorschach. And he's like, what? And I'm like, do you want to do it? And he said, yes. And it was like, there was no hesitancy at all.
Yeah.
Which convinced me. It's like, all right, let's do it. Mm. You know, and then the other thing was like, well, if we don't do it, they're going to do it anyway. At least we give a shit about them.
Yeah.
You know?
Indeed.
So, yeah, it was like, you know, let's do it. Let's do the best job we can. Like, let's come up with a story. It's like, we're not going to really screw with this mythos at all. Let's sort of underline it. I thought, like, look, I can read Watchmen, and I think that Alan's influences, especially with Rorschach, come through. Like, it's his. He wore them really on his sleeve for that, especially with that character.
Yeah.
So I said, we'll just go to the same ones. You know, we'll go to the same well. We won't use what Alan did, but we're going to go to the same stuff that Alan did, and just like, let's go to Taxi Driver. Let's tell a you know, a 70s sort of, you know, American dirty, grimy cinema. Yeah. Stuff they don't make anymore.
Well, I don't know, have you seen any of the films by S. Craig Zahler? I think that kind of stuff's coming back into fashion, but only now.
I mean, like, most of that stuff's coming, you know, the large screen's not where it's at anymore. You know? It's a small screen. That's rated R is on TV.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You mentioned noir, and you've just mentioned Taxi Driver. In terms of kind of the writers and the stories that formed you as a creator, who would you say were your influences?
Comic creator?
Comics or film?
I would say definitely Alan.
Okay.
Alan Moore. Frank Miller, of course. Who else did I like? Storyteller-wise. I mean, those guys... Dan Klaus.
No, well, you know, why not?
Jaime and Gilbert. I'm trying to think about what I was reading.
But they're all people who kind of, like, push the medium forward. So obviously that's something that's interested you.
Howard Chaykin. I argue with people that, like, there wouldn't be adult comics without Howard. He started it. You know? American Flag, that's ground zero.
Okay.
Not Watchmen or Dark Knight. American Flag. But, yeah, I guess, I mean, that was the kind of stuff that interested me. You know, not nothing safe, you know? When I was younger, like, Warlock, Jim Starlin was like, it's like, that blew my mind.
Yeah.
When he kills himself.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa. The greatest storyteller was Joe Kubert. His covers told the best stories. You know, it was like, because I loved the war comics and I would buy them. And the interior story were like never as good as the story that was told on the cover.
Yeah.
And it was like, I feel incredibly fortunate to have been able to work with him.
So there were, obviously then, there were several comics that you found kind of really influential in your formative years. Because, you know, when we were talking earlier, having a career in the comics industry seems like something that was almost one of many possible routes you could have taken as an adult. But maybe young Brian is actually really proud of adult Brian for working in the industry.
I'll have to ask him when he shows up to kill me. Yeah, no, I'm very happy to be. Yeah, I've had a good... If Batman Damned is what brings me down, it was a good run.
You mentioned Frank Miller as being someone who you found influential when you were young, and more recently you've been working with him on the third Dark Knight serial. How does the process of collaboration work between the two of you?
The way that it worked was the mechanics of it is, like, Frank has... We have two different approaches to telling stories. Frank's, he has moments.
Okay.
All right? I have dominoes.
Okay.
So with Dark Knight, we were talking, it was like, I want this to happen, and I want this to happen, and I want this to happen, and this. He told me all these things that he wants in the story. And I'm like, all right, but, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And you know, the order that he was describing things, and he said, like, oh, I know, it's like, that's what you're supposed to do. So it's like, here's the puzzle, put it together, come back and put it together, or come back with it put together, and then we'll go from there.
Okay.
And then once I had things in order, you know, we went back and forth, and it's like, we'll move stuff around a little bit, and then it was like, all right, now we're going to sit around in his studio and talk the characters. So we're doing voices. and none of that is recorded.
Okay.
But Frank does an interesting Batman.
Mm.
But as, you know, someone who's normally works as a solo writer, is that quite a fun experience, bouncing ideas off someone else and working in a way that you wouldn't normally?
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, it was really fun. But then, like, you know, I work with people that I have fun working with. Mm. Now, you know? Yeah, that was... And was it a new experience for having a collaborator like that? Well, having Frank Miller as a collaborator, yeah, that was a new experience. But it was great. It was really great. Will we do it again? Maybe.
Mm. And you've also written a couple of the DC animated films. Presumably that was a different experience again, particularly when you're adapting a classic comic and reworking it for, you know, moving pictures.
Yeah, it was an interesting, more controversy.
Indeed.
Yes, it was interesting. It was interesting. I think there's a certain part in Killing Joke. There's elements that I... All right, the way that thing was, the original genesis of that project was, we're going to do Killing Joke. Do you want to write it? Yes, I would like the opportunity. Because you're going to do it.
Yeah. So it might as well be me.
Might as well be me, yeah. And it was like, because I knew, it's like, well, I'll be very respectful to the source material. And, or so I thought. And then it was, all right, there are parts, and they said, like, look, when you break this down, and these are people coming from animation, Alan Burnett, who was really instrumental in getting me into this, and then Bruce Timm, it was like, when you break this down, you're gonna find out you've got 20 or a 25 minute story with Killing Joke, because that story is much less dense than you think. It broke it down, and I was like, yeah, and it's like, so you need to add at least, so like, you need to add 7 minutes to that. That story. So there are parts in the Killing Joke proper that I added that I think really are in the flavor of what was done originally. Then the other part was that was all done, ready. They're ready to go into production with it. It was going to be R-rated, and it was going to be approved on a Monday. Over the weekend before it was approved, Watchmen, the film, happened.
Okay.
All right?
Huh.
And Watchmen, the film, didn't do so well.
Oh, okay.
So the studio said, well, they don't want R-rated superheroes. So it didn't get approved. Flash forward, and I get a call from Alan and from Bruce, and the phone together, and it's like, listen, we're going to do this now. They're like, oh, okay. Well, great. But we're not going to... We need it to be longer. So we need something... We need something more. And I'm like, yeah. There's really... I said, like, there's nothing that can be added to that story that won't dilute it, I thought. So no, we don't want you to add to the story you did. We want you to do something that happens before. And I'm like, well, I don't think we should be doing anything with Batman or Joker. Like, that story is so tight. And they're like... No. Well, what would you do? Well, Barbara Gordon is she's a plot device in Killing Joke.
Yeah.
You know, she's there to make cocoa, get shot, get stripped.
Yeah.
That's all. So it was like, we need to tell something about her. And let's tell a story about why she quits being Batgirl. Because she wasn't Batgirl by the time... When Killing Joke started, I just assumed she wasn't Batgirl anymore.
Okay.
You know, she was a librarian. Just look, Batgirl...
would have been able to...
Would have done something instead of dropped a coffee cup.
Yeah, good point.
So then we did the story of, you know, her getting... She's not Bruce. She can't live that lifestyle without it affecting her the rest of her life. And then people went nuts. Some of them. Which is great, you know?
Yeah.
So what next for Brian Azzarello? I'm not going to ask you for some kind of, you know, exclusive, but are there certain kind of genres, certain kind of stories that you haven't told yet, certain mediums you haven't worked in yet that in an ideal world you'd like to have a go at?
Let's see what happens.
Okay.
There's more moonshine on the horizon. Damned, hopefully. There's some other things I'm talking to DC about.
But I mean, you haven't got, say, an itch to write a space opera or a novel or a romantic comedy or something.
No, no. Supernatural erotica. That's what's on the horizon, too, as well.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
To keep up with Brian Azzarello, you can follow him on Twitter at Brian Azzarello. That's AZZARELLO. And for more information about the MCM Comic Con, where my interview with Brian was recorded, please go to mcmcomiccon.com. The second issue of Batman Damned by Brian Azzarello, featuring 100% less images of Batman's nether regions, is available later this month in all good comic shops. Should you find yourself in a comic shop in London, there are various events taking place throughout the month. And on December the 13th, there's the launch of The Second Coming of Krent Abel, taking place at Gosh Comics on Berwick Street, in which the author will be signing copies of his latest book from Knockabout Comics, and that's on December the 13th from 7 p.m. For more information about all Gosh events, please go to goshlondon.com. Just across town, on Saturday the 15th of December, the White Noise Collective will be at Orbital Comics from 5 p.m. on Saturday the 15th, including creators Ram V, Dan Waters, Ryan O'Sullivan and Alex Packnadel. And they'll be signing from 5, just around the corner from Leicester Square Tube. And for more information about all Orbital events, please go to orbitalcomics.com. At Forbidden Planet Megastore on Shaftesbury Avenue, on December the 12th, Anthony Del Col will be signing the new Luke Cage comic, Everyman, from 6 p.m. On December the 14th, Jock will be signing the new Batman spin-off comic, Batman Who Laughs, from 6 p.m. For more information about all Forbidden Planet events, please go to forbiddenplanet.com/events. This month, the Illustration Cupboard on Bury Street in London will be holding its final exhibition, with work on display from Shirley Hughes, E.H. Shepherd, Angela Barrett, Sean Tan, and many others. And in the bookshop, they have several signed editions of terrific titles by all of these authors for up to 50% off. The Illustration Cupboard has been an amazing venue for exhibitions of comic book and children's book illustration art over the years. So if you're a long-term fan or have never been to the gallery before, please go along this month before your chance has gone forever. And for more information about the Illustration Cupboard, please go to illustrationcupboard.com. Panel Borders was recorded, edited and introduced by Alex Fitch and is a Panel Borders production. You can find all our previous episodes at www.panelborders.wordpress.com, where you can find interviews with many other 2000 AD creators, such as Clint Langley, Frank Quietly, Dave Gibbons, Leah Moore, Annie Parkhouse, and many more. Ian Rankin isn't the only novelist with an interest in comics, and you can also find my interviews online with the likes of China Mieville and Denise Mina. And we'll have an extended midwinter special in the first week of January, where I'll be talking to three comic book creators, Rachel Ball, The Surreal McCoy, and Ian Edgington, about their projects about wolves. Until then, hope you have a fantastic Christmas and New Year. Thanks for listening.
This program was brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. Visit our website at resonancefm.com to hear our vast range of original 24/7 broadcasts. Resonance is a not-for-profit broadcast platform and relies on public support. If you like what you've heard, make a secure donation at resonancefm.com.